uyakwazi ukuthumela ama-email na.
We translate for those who can't understand. We write for those who can't hear. We describe for those who can't see. SubT, subtitles and accessibility for film, television and theater. SubT.com.
Fred Team Radio, this is Nicolo Comotti here at Venice Days.
Fred Team Radio, sono Chiara Nicoletti.
Angelo Acerbi per Fred Team Radio, on è al Festival di Venice.
Fred Film Radio, z vami sono Borg Kuterzyk.
Fred Film Radio, radio filmowe Fred, z tej strony Anna Tatarska.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Cinephile, you're listening to the Big Fred Tuesday, Fred Film Radio's weekly show on all things cinema with a particular focus on independent filmmaking and the international film festival scene. This show is hosted and produced by yours truly, Matt Micucci. Each week I bring you brand new conversations with filmmakers, prominent figures of the film industry and film talent from all four corners of the globe, and this week will be no different. We'll specifically be taking a closer look at three films being presented in the programme of this year's Vilnius Film Festival in Lithuania, which started on the 18th of March and will continue through the 24th of April. And it's happening in a very unusual way. It's taking place in six of the top hotels in the Lithuanian capital, complete with red carpets, as hundreds of hotel rooms have been turned into de facto screening rooms with all of the festival films available through the television. And we'll be able to talk about this more with the artistic director of the festival soon. But there you go. This is another innovative way in which international film festivals have been countering these coronavirus times, and probably more productive than Gothenburg's idea to do the same thing, but just for one person on a deserted island somewhere. Of course, we're all looking forward to being back in the cinema soon, but it's well worth exploring these ideas for the next time that we will be faced with the threat of an inevitable apocalypse. As mentioned, we'll be taking a closer look at three of the films that are part of this year's Vilnius Film Festival in Lithuania. Specifically, we'll be talking about Air Conditioner, a new film from Angola, with one of the architects of its burgeoning film scene and the film director of Air Conditioner, Fradik. We'll also be speaking with the talented Lithuanian filmmaker Saulė Bliuvaitė, who presented her first documentary short Limousine at the festival's short competition. And we'll end it all with a chat with filmmaker Danny Rosenberg, director of The Death of Cinema and My Father Too. All throughout the show, we will be revisiting gems from our fabled archive. There will be new additions to our amazing Dictionary of Film and Popcorn Classics segment. The best things in life are free, including the Big Fred Tuesday. So whether you're in a five-star hotel or in a beat-up caravan, if you're listening to me and you love the movies, fire up on Audiotini, sit back, relax, and listen to the audio waves as they fly through the air.
Fred.
Joining us at this time is filmmaker Fradik. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Matt.
And you know, you're talking with us from Luanda in Angola. We're going to be talking about your latest film, Air Conditioner, which is screened as part of this year's program of the Vilnius Film Festival. So very exciting. I watched it and I thought it was great. There's so much I want to ask you. But just to start us off, would you be able to maybe say a few words about your film to introduce it for the listeners who may not be familiar with it yet?
Well, Air Conditioner is a film that takes place here in my hometown, Luanda, and it takes place in downtown. The main protagonist is a security guard, and we follow him through a couple of days of work, and at the same time, air conditioners are falling in the city of Luanda, and people don't know why and how, and so the rest, you have to watch the film.
Exactly, yeah. So that part of the reason why I ask filmmakers to introduce their films is so that I don't give anything away. But, but you know, okay, so there's so much that I want to ask you, like I said. But the film is also credited to the collective that you started, which I hope I'm not mispronouncing completely, Geração 80. I don't know.
Yes, 80, that's exactly what it means, Generation 80. Yeah.
Generation 80, yeah. Can you tell me a bit about the origins of this collective and maybe its mission statement?
Yeah, we started in 2010 after I finished shooting my first short film when I got back to Angola. And me and two other friends, Jorge and Chiloya, decided to start this to make films, but soon realized that it was very hard to keep ourselves just doing films here because we don't have like film funds or we don't have a specific industry regarding filmmaking or anything. So we decided to open more of a production part of the company, which was more commercial. But at the same time, the collective that was doing the films was growing. So right now, we have done, I think, 5 feature films, mainly documentary, and 2 feature films fiction, and the rest was short films. And it's been a very important experience to us. And basically, we take every year, we take a person's turn. So in 2020, 2019 was Air Conditioner, was my film. Next was Eddie Clavers, who was the director of photography of Air Conditioner, and I'm editing his film. So we kind of work on each other's film like a film school mindset, and that makes us, I think, more appreciative of everyone's work, I guess.
So a major objective of this collective is kind of to represent Angola, but also to maybe give birth to a burgeoning film scene there?
I wouldn't say just represent Angola, but what we feel is that there's a lot of filmmaking going and a lot of filmmaking trying to copy Western filmmaking or, you know, Hollywood. And then you get names like Nollywood, or here in Angola, people calling Angoliwood. And we feel like there's a lot of good artists with a lot of people with stories to tell that don't fit that box. And basically, we are more independent, auto-driven filmmakers, and at the same time working as a collective, you know. We don't think that one abolishes the other, you know.
Yeah, so the artistic vision of the individual is very important to you as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very important for us. And I think the what's weird for some collectives is that although we are working with, you know, one director's per project's vision, but we are working all together. And we work on each other's projects.
To return to Air Conditioner, which, again, I must say that I was totally, I loved it. I felt one of the themes that was very important was the theme of memory. Why did you feel it was an important theme to explore?
I have a deep connection with memories. I'm a person that every film that I've made, or even every story that I think, most of the times they come to me or they become some sort of memory, because every time I'm thinking about it or even writing, they kind of start becoming memory in my own mind, you know. And at the same time, I think we, as filmmakers, when we are telling these stories and we are getting into the visual medium, we kind of are building almost fake memories into one society. If I think about all the films I've seen from very different parts of the world, I always think that, you know, it's a window to a country's time and space or city or even a character. So for me, filmmaking, or films at least, work a lot as memories. And also because in my previous project, which was a documentary about our independence, I worked during 6 years with our collective and an archive association on our country's archives and also archives outside of Angola, but about our liberation struggle. So anything to do with archives, memories, old stuff, I love it.
Yeah, me too. One of the pet battles of mine on this show is film preservation. So I love it when people, you know, talk about how important it is for these memories to be kept alive in some way. Mm-hmm. But I've also seen, and this is kind of takes me to another thing that I wanted to discuss with you, because I've seen this film described as a work of magic realism, mm-hmm. you know, balancing realism with poetic imagery and metaphor. And I also saw that as representing a sort of balance between the interior and exterior world of the lead character of the film, mm-hmm. Matasedo. Would you agree with that?
I would say one of the main things that I wanted to with the film, and also with every aspect of filmmaking, like not only the photography, with the music, with the camera, we wanted to give always the perspective of Matasedo. Either you are seeing it or not. So even the composer, Aline Frazan, I think she composed an amazing soundtrack that speaks to what the character is thinking or what the character is made of, instead of just adding music to a scene, you know? And the photography is, I think it works as well this way, because we kind of floating with him while he's walking those corridors or walking those streets. But more than just capturing him in action, we are kind of going on his rhythm. So I love that we all decided to go with this approach, because it gave the film kind of a cohesive element to it, you know.
Yeah, and speaking of just this pace, but also the dreamlike quality of the film mm-hmm. that I felt, some of the sets are quite beautiful, and I was wondering what the influences for those sets were. Some of them are really stunning, I must say.
Thank you, Matt. Well, it's I've lived all my entire life in buildings like the one you see in the film. Not only me, but the composer, the co-writer, the director of photography, the whole crew, basically, mostly live downtown and those sort of buildings. So we knew the environment very well. And I think the building was a real location, and the shop was a real location. We added stuff, of course, and we changed according to other experience from other buildings. But mainly the location were real. Like if that shop doesn't exist with air conditioners, but it exists with television screens. So I think the most, the biggest inspiration was our daily lives, you know, our daily lives of citizens of Luanda.
Right. Yeah. But some of them really looked like art installation pieces. Mm-hmm. I thought they were really, really great.
Yeah. The car one was, it's one of the ones I love the most, because the art director Prudenciana Hash, she built the car inside with a garage shop here, and it was an amazing piece, and it's still there. The guy of the shop didn't take it out, so the car is part of the shop now, almost as something people to visit.
We've got to take a break, but stick around. We'll be back with Fradique to talk more about air conditioner in a moment.
Fred.
We're back with Fradique speaking about Air Conditioner, his film, which was part of this year's Vilnius Film Festival lineup. And I almost feel embarrassed to ask you because of the sheer simplicity of the question, but is there a specific reason behind your choice of using air conditioners as central props in your movie?
The reason would be that I think the air conditioner itself represents a lot in terms of the symbolism of it, of being downtown. Most of the buildings, old buildings downtown, have them hanging, and they seem like they can fall at any moment, like the buildings itself, they seem they can fall at any moment. And also because there's something there inside and outside, you know, and it takes place, and also it doesn't take place, it takes care of, supposedly, of our air, of what we breathe. I know that it sounds very strange now that we're living through a pandemic, but I always felt like it was a very good metaphor for kind of the tension that we live here in this city, you know?
Yeah, we talked about memory earlier. One of my favorite quotes that anyone has ever said about cinemas or cameras, and I bring it up quite a lot, is Wim Wenders once said mm-hmm. that the camera is a weapon against the tragedy of things disappearing. So when you're filming, like you said, the mm-hmm. type of buildings that you grew up in, do you also take pleasure in just documenting them? Because, like you said, these are buildings that are crumbling, and they're not, you know, they may mm-hmm. be here today, but gone tomorrow.
Well, I'm very grateful that you quote Wim Wenders. I'm a big fan, and it's one of those filmmakers that every now and then I go back to it just to watch it and rewatch it, because I think he does very well combining, you know, documentary and fiction, and making real memories of characters, you know, and of real people at the same time. And I think that what I try to do with filmmaking, what we are trying to do as a collective as well, is some sort of way to have a memory of the places and the stories that we once told, you know. I look back at some of our early films that were in different parts of town that don't exist anymore, of they changed completely, of they being gentrified. So for me, it's important to have that aspect as well, you know, kind of like an archive of our city. And we'll see what happens to that building a couple of years from now. But the good thing, it's story, and some of these habitants of the building that were part of the film as actors and production crew also will be remembered because of this film. And I think that's a good thing as well.
There's so much that I want to ask you, but we talked about you mentioned the importance of music mm-hmm. in this film, and I love the music as well in Air Conditioner. I was thinking as well that while I was watching it, to borrow a musical term, I really appreciated the groove of this film. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I found this at times hypnotic. So I wondered, how important is it for you when you're putting the film together? How important is rhythm and pace for you?
For me, music is as important as the camera, as the narrative, as the characters. Because I think filmmaking is one of the best arts that we have. Because we can play with so many tools. It's not just music. It's not just photography. So what I tried to do, and because I remember a lot during film school years and even my early projects, that you're so focused on narrative, you're so focused on plot or the photography, and you kind of forget something that is very important, music and sound, you know. And one of the things that I tried to write from the get-go, even when I'm writing the screenplay, is to say whatever music I'm thinking for the scene or where I would like to have some music on. And in this project, we involved the composer, Lynn Frazon, from early on while we were writing the script. So I think that gave me a completely different experience, and it's something that I really want to do moving forward with other projects. Because once you have a composer attached to the project, it's good to have the conversation when you have a new conversation with the director of photography. And because that clearly inspires you and gives you a better understanding of what you're trying to do with the music. And the composer can come up with a lot of good things like Aline did. Like, I was completely surprised when I heard the first tracks, because I was like, that's exactly where I was thinking, or that's not what I was thinking, but this is perfect for it, you know? And I always tell people, and the other day I was talking to a class of filmmakers, and I was telling them, do not forget music, do not forget sound, and pay attention to art direction as well. It seems like we as filmmakers, especially directors, tend to focus too much on plot or, you know, on photography.
Yeah, it sounds like from what you're telling me, and also from having seen the film, that rather than being interested in a traditionalist approach in the construction of a narrative, you're more dynamic than that. You're more dynamic when you're constructing even the story.
Yeah, because I've been in love with films that take their time there to suggest feelings and to suggest emotions or what the character is going through or what the environment feels like, more than being completely stuck with the narrative. It's not something that I dislike. I love to see narrative films. I have a lot of films that I like that are very narrative. But from this moment, or at least at this moment right now, I think the best way to explain or suggest the stories I'm trying to tell is to convey to emotion with photography, with music. And at the end, I want people, at least with this film, to be on the shoes of the main character by the end of the film, more than anything else.
And where did the actors fit into that creative process?
Well, the actors for me, it's like I'm not trying to find actors that are trained actors only. I try to find people that fit the role. Like, to tell you the truth, for the main character, we're looking actually for someone that was 60 years old, like an older guy. But we're not able to get an actor that was I couldn't find someone that I like. And plus, we were having a lot of problems with casting agencies that didn't want their actors to play a security guard because they saw it was a minor role. And which was funny because he was the protagonist of the film. But at the end, we found José Kitekulu, which is actually a line producer. And the first time that he came in, we already had the other actors, and he came in to do a scene with Zazinha, which is the housemaid. And once he sat down and started talking, he had the soul of an old person, you know, although he was not that old. And for me, that's more important when I'm looking for actors to play the part. It's like that you you take the part right from the get-go. I don't mind if not saying the line correctly or if you don't memorize text or lines. Like, if you look the part and if you can carry the emotion up, for me, that's the most important part. And the other thing is I'm not looking for a way, like, this is my way to work with actors. I like to adapt to whoever I have, because they kind of are representing the film, representing the character. So for me, it's more important to find the right person and not be so much worried where the person comes from, or if it's a woman or a man, or if it's an actor or a non-actor, you know.
Do you think that approach also comes a little bit from your work within the documentary form?
Yeah, for sure, because I've met so many people these last years and seen so many people here in the city. It's amazing how you can find so many talented people that can play different roles. You know, we as human beings play different characters almost every day, you know, and it's in this city, you can find really talented people and doesn't have to be an actor, you know. But at the same time, I love to work with actors, and I'm always trying to have both in the same project, because I think that energy between actors and non-actors, it's also a good energy to have on set if they respect each other, because people are trying to be at their best game, you know, while they're doing the project.
Yeah. So, Fradik, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Matt.
Fred Film Radio.
Another film screening at the Vilnius Film Festival this year is Apples by Christos Nikou. Interestingly, it was the opening film of the Orizzonti section at last year's Venice Film Festival, and it will be the closing film of this year's Vilnius Film Festival. Angelo Cerbi caught up with the Greek filmmaker in Venice last year, and let's revisit that interview right now.
I was very intrigued by your film because it's fascinating in a very simple way, but very affecting. It's a story of this man who forgot who he is, and it's like he's taught how to build up a new persona again, and through different steps and through different, also very funny and comical moments. It's a movie about memory and the connection between memory and our personal identity. What brought you to tell us this story? What was the inspiration for it?
I always love to watch movies that create a dark world, that creates worlds that are a little bit surreal, have a different condition from the one that we live in right now, and they change a little bit the rules of our society. So in 2012, when I started having the idea of the script, it was a moment that I was trying to cope with the loss of my father, mm-hmm. But I couldn't. And because my father used to have a very strong memory, and he was eating a lot of apples, I always had this image on my mind that he was eating 7 to 8 apples per day. So I was trying to cope with his loss, but as I said, I couldn't, and at the same time, I was trying to understand why people forget so easily, and how selective is our memory, and if we will erase something that hurt us, are we going to lose our existence, and could it be that we are the things we don't forget, that we are only our memories?
Actually, at least to me, it worked like kind of a meditation about the relationship between memory and how it influences our perception of ourselves and our day-to-day life. The kind of, how selective is. So what do we remember about our past and what we don't? In this specific moment, technology is very strong, helping us probably, or maybe not. Is it helping or not?
I think that not. That's why we set also the movie in a timeless period when everything is analog and nothing is digital. Because I believe that when the technology started being more omnipresent in our lives, our mind became more lazier. As there is no need to save something in your mind anymore. You store everything in devices. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, devices from the company Apple. So it's an irony about...
about the title of the film itself,
yes.
Of course. You choose the form of the comedy drama. This plot could have been easily a very serious drama, why, like a form of narrative. Why you choose like a more comical, surreal one? Why that?
Because as life contains mixed elements from comedy and tragic. Nothing is only tragic. Nothing is only comedy. So I believe that movies should be like that. And especially when you have to make a movie that has such a tragic topic, it's much better to show it through comedy. Maybe more difficult, but I think that
It's maybe more difficult, but it's truly more effective.
It's more effective. That's exactly what I want to say. And I don't think that I could ever be able to direct something that it doesn't have comedy in it. I love comedy, so.
Actually, the story of this man who is taught in this institution on how to rebuild a new life, and he is asked to record and to photograph every single action he does, even the simplest task, like going on a bicycle. Everything is very surreal. It's like a Buster Keaton film sometimes, you know? And was it difficult to keep that pace, to keep that sign in the narrative, not risking to be too over comical or over dramatical?
At the beginning, when we first when we wrote the first draft of the script was only comedy. I mean that it was much more. And then we decided to try to find the right balance, which wasn't so easy. As maybe we could be, you know, more comedic or more dramatic, and the movie could lose the essence and why we did it. But we hope that we find the right balance.
I want to ask you something about the aesthetics of the film, because it's very precise and very effective and very defined. Besides the time space, which is not exactly defined, but also the colors and the aesthetics are kind of a vintage one, but with a precise palette of colors too.
Yes, about the color grading, for example, we followed something that it looks more close to Polaroid cameras, the colors. We decided to do it in that way. And also, we selected the 4:3 aspect ratio because it's the Academy ratio, and it's a ratio that is almost forgotten. And it's more close to the Polaroid square ratio.
I want to ask one last question about your career. You have been assistant director to Yorgos Lanthimos on Dogtooth and with Richard Linklater Before Sunrise. What did you...
Before Midnight.
Before Midnight, yes. Sorry. Before Midnight. So what did you bring back from those experiences into your craft that you are using, that you are...
In all the movies that I worked as an assistant director, because I worked in six more than two, they helped me a lot because it was my school in a way, as I'm a self-taught director. And what I admire a lot to Yorgos, for example, is that he's a 24/7 person. I haven't seen a person that works so much. He's super talented, and he lives and breathes cinema. And about Linklater is that how greatly he was working with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, and how they were like a family, and they were creating all together the movie from the first moment until the last. And that's a great way to shoot a film.
To shoot a film, absolutely. Well, thank you very much to Christos Nikou, director of Apples at Orizzonti here at the Venice Film Festival. I'm Angela Cherby for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio.
Joining us at this time is Saulė Bliuvaitė, director of the Lithuanian short film Limousine from the shorts competition of the Vilnius Film Festival. Saulė, welcome to the show.
Hi.
It's a pleasure to talk with you. We're going to be talking about your latest short film. It's titled Limousine, and it was screened in the short competition of the Vilnius Film Festival. Just to introduce it a little bit for our listeners, just very, very briefly, you essentially filmed groups of people from different generations in a limousine, as the title suggests, and sort of observed how they behaved in this lavish setting. The first question that I'd like to ask you is, what was the origin of this idea?
Well, actually, I had this idea while I was studying in the Lithuanian Academy of Music and Theater, you know, where I was doing a bachelor in film studies. We had an assignment which was called Night in Vilnius. And our professor, a well-known documentary filmmaker, Audrey Stonis, he asked us to film something in our city for 1 hour. So I thought that I always wanted to see what's inside those limousines that were cruising, you know, in the city in the nighttime. So I took my camera and I filmed something in the limousine, and I was fascinated because I didn't expect what I saw there. And, you know, it was this crazy, delirious atmosphere there. So, well, later I wanted to make a film with more groups of people. So, yeah.
What is it that fascinated you about limousines?
You know, it always fascinated me that there is a vehicle that it's meant to not to take you from point A to point B, but it was designed so that people could sit inside and do something, you know, and spend time as in a bar together, you know. So I was fascinated with this vehicle. I was always thinking, you know, does it make a difference if you sit inside a bar or if you're riding somewhere? What's the point of doing that? And well, yeah, I thought, what is it about? Do you feel better if you feel that you're going somewhere? So from this question, everything, you know, started. I mean, it started from the question, why do you need to have a feeling of going somewhere, of moving somewhere while you are, you know, hanging out with your friends?
Does it also, like, does that fascination also entail an interest in perhaps investigating the symbolic status of a limousine within society?
Yeah, yeah.
Being in a limousine, you know, you may be a powerful person riding
yeah.
in a limousine. It gives you that feeling of being important or famous or a celebrity.
Yeah, that's a great point because, you know, I was growing up in Lithuania during, you know, the beginning of 21st century, and the limousine was something, you know, out of this world. And, you know, it has those dark windows where you cannot see what's inside. And when I was a child, you know, the limousine is passing by and you think, you know, the president is there or some movie star. And yeah, there is a status and a sense of power about that. So yeah, that was a good point.
Yeah, you just reminded me that when I was a kid growing up, and I mean, I was born in Genoa, then grew up in Ireland. I remember there was a limousine riding around town for a couple of days and it would pass by our school. And, you know, the kids in the schoolyard just got this idea in their head that they were absolutely certain that it was Sylvester Stallone, which of course probably it wasn't. But, you know, that's what we knew absolutely that he, you know, any day he would pop out of that car, that limo, and just like, you know, be Sylvester Stallone around Genoa. But anyways, how did it work? Did you invite the people to ride on a limo, or had they already planned to do it themselves and then you would just approach them that way?
Yeah, no, there were some people that we were shooting, you know, they initially ordered the limousine and we asked if we can shoot them. And there were some people which I wanted to add for this, you know, diversity. So we asked some groups of people, some friends, to take the limousine for 1 hour and to let us film them. So, yeah.
Well, what did they say?
They were really excited about that because they got a free ride in the limousine. You know?
Yeah. And were they going somewhere, or was it just you're in the limousine and that's it?
We told all of the people that they could... they could do whatever they wanted, and they could go where they want and, you know, get out of the limousine as many times as they wanted and do whatever they wanted. So they chose, you know, different places where to go. But many, many people wanted to go to the night shop to buy alcohol.
Right.
So there are a few segments, you know, in the film, where you can, you know, you can know where are they going.
That's interesting, because I'm just asking myself what I would do if I was in a limo. I'd probably get it to park outside any of the nightclubs in town and just get out, pop into the nightclub for about 5 seconds, and then pop back into the limo and do that at every nightclub in town. What would you do, incidentally, if you were to just ride a limo?
I don't know. I think I would go around the places where my friends live, you know, and surprise them and just... when they go out, I just would drag them inside the car. And
we'll be back for more in a moment.
Fred.
We're back with Lithuanian filmmaker Saulė Bliuvaitė, and we have been talking about Limousine, her short film presented in the shorts competition of the Vilnius Film Festival. This is an observational documentary that essentially takes place in one location, which, as the title suggests, is a limousine. And I was thinking, Saulė, is it difficult to plan a shoot in a restricted setting like this one? Because, after all, a limousine may be a big car, but it's still a car.
Yeah, it was. It wasn't very hard technically, but we had some challenges, especially with the sound, because, you know, we had to put a lot of microphones in the inside of the car because all of the passengers wanted to listen to music, very loud music. But we couldn't restrict them, you know, because they would, they felt better when the music was blasting very loud. And so they could talk, you know, about the things that they were talking. Because if we would, wouldn't let to play the music, they would be, you know, shy and wouldn't feel good.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a challenge that you had to overcome. But
yeah,
you set up the microphones, and then was there someone in the limo actually filming?
The cameraman was inside, and I was driving in the passenger seat next to the driver. So yeah, most of the time, sometimes I would just go behind the limo in the separate car and just try to catch the signal for the monitor that I had.
Yeah. And of course, you didn't know what would happen. So this is an observational documentary, basically. You didn't want to intrude or interfere with the actions.
Yeah, it was a very good experience for me because this was the first documentary that I made. And it was really, you know, we had to shoot a lot of hours. I think we have like 15 to 17 hours of footage, because, you know, we had to film everything. And sometimes we had two cameras with the second cameraman. So yeah, we had to shoot a lot, and we wouldn't know what will happen. So.
Right. And yeah, like you said, this is your first documentary, but you did, I think this is your fifth short, right? This is your fifth short film. Your previous ones had been works of fiction.
Yeah, actually it's my fourth.
Oh, your fourth. Okay.
Yeah, but the previous shorts were fiction.
What is it that interests you about the documentary form and that prompted you to make this debut?
You know, it fascinated me in the process, because when I started to make it, I was thinking in the same way that I think when I'm making fiction. So I just thought what the film will look like and what's going to happen there and how it's going to start, how is it going to end. But when we were, you know, in the middle, in the shooting of this film, I realized that it's not going to go the way I planned. And so I just, during all the days that we were shooting, I was just trying to figure out what kind of film I'm going to make. I had the initial ideas, but they were shifting, you know, all the time. And so basically, when I knew that I have enough weird moments and that we're going to end the shooting, but so I knew that we're going to end, but I didn't know what the film is going to look like. And, you know, the film was born in the editing room.
And do you think, just looking at the footage that you filmed, was there something that you understood, you know, considering that you did film different generations of people, about the ways in which different generations behaved in a setting like this. I mean, what were some of the things that you maybe discovered about the human condition or just human nature in general?
Well, you know, I thought that it's going to be so different, you know, that the people from different generations are going to act like, you know, the day and night. But what I realized when I was listening to all the conversations, and that's what I put in film, you know, that the people are talking somehow, they're talking about different things, but somehow it's all the same. And for me, it felt like it's not different people, but they're all the same, that somehow they're just one group going from different stages of their life. Yeah, so what I realized that we're all in the same boat.
Yeah, in a way, when you think about it, the limousine with all those people in it, it's almost like this thing that you're in, but you have no control over the direction in which it goes. So it could be a metaphor for life itself.
Yeah.
Okay, so getting back to the fact that this is your first documentary film, but also the fact that it's an observational documentary, do you think that observing, the act of observing, or just an observational process in general, is part of your filmmaking process, even when you're working on a fiction work, maybe part of the way in which you put your films together, you research your topics?
Well, I think that the observation is in general the most important thing in making art, you know, because you can construct the world in a way that you think. How does it look like? What it is? But sometimes as a director, you feel like some kind of god, you know, constructing new world, which all the viewers have to go by its rules. So for me, this documentary kind of reminded me that all the things, all the beauty comes from the observation. And then you have to observe first and then to put this puzzle together. So somehow this film, making of this film, somehow it humbled me in a way. And I'm really grateful for that.
Do you think, what are you working on at the moment now? Are you going to continue with the documentaries or are you planning fiction again?
Well, actually I'm in a pre-production stage of my first feature film. It's fiction, and yeah, I just finished the script, and yeah, I'm in the pre-production of the shooting, so, well, I hope it goes well.
And have these COVID times been impacting your creativity in any way? Have you found it a hindrance? Or some people that I've spoken with have actually found it helpful because with the lockdowns, they've been forced to stay at home and work on that script and just plan everything.
Yeah, well, actually, it was a good time to work on the script because I was working on the two feature film scripts now this past year. So it was a great time to, you know, to focus on that. But in a way, when you're stuck and you have a writer's block, which I think everyone experiences, so, well, you want to go outside, you want to go to the bar, you know, and drink some cocktails and just refresh your mind and just mingle in the crowd of people, and you cannot do that. So it was hard to overcome the moments when you lacking inspiration.
Yeah, I understand that. All right, Saule, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you, and I wish you all the best with this film, but also with your feature film project too. We'll be looking forward to seeing it soon.
Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio.
Cinephile, welcome to a brand new segment of our weekly dictionary of film. Today, we get a little more ambitious in scope, as for the letter D, I will be talking about the short-lived but intense Dogma 95 movement, which is still ongoing to this day to some extent, but that is generally recognized to have lasted about 10 years from 1995 to 2005. Its originators were Danish directors Lars von Trier and Thomas Vinterberg, but it soon became an international cinematic expression that extended far beyond the Danish borders. Von Trier and Vinterberg crafted the movement's manifesto, which came to be known as the Vow of Chastity. This was a set of rules that Dogma 95 directors had to abide by in order to essentially offer a viable counter to cinema's increasing over-reliance on technology and special effects and place a greater focus on traditional storytelling, performance, and specific themes. Some of the best-known rules included exclusive use of handheld camera, lack of almost anything artificial, including any image manipulation, and of non-diegetic sounds, shooting on location with no outside props, and so on. Famously, the final rule stated that the director should not be credited. As a whole, these rules outlined a movement that was in direct opposition to commercial studio filmmaking at the time and was a clear attempt to give greater power to independent creative teams. This is also proven by the rule that stated that the only accepted format for Dogma 95 was Academy 35mm, which was the same format used by the commercial films. It was Lars von Trier who officially inaugurated the movement at a 1995 conference held in Paris in celebration of the 100 years of cinema. Before his speech, he handed out red pamphlets with these rules, which collectively became known as a vow of chastity, accosting Dogma 95 to a type of process of creative purification. 3 years after the manifesto's announcement, Thomas Vinterberg released the first Dogma 95 film, Festin, which was an instant critical success, winning the jury prize at the 1998 Cannes Film Festival. That same year, von Trier released the second Dogma 95 film, The Idiots, which was less successful and provoked a storm of publicity and debate, one of which was about the fictional representation of disability. In addition to releasing these films, Vinterberg and von Trier continued to act as ambassadors for the movement and even tried to convince famous filmmakers to make a Dogma 95 movie. But they soon lost interest in the movement and began to distance themselves from their own creation. By the turn of the 21st century, Dogma 95 became a more international affair via such titles as Harmony Korine's Julian Donkey Boy from 1999, while some mainstream success was such movies as Lona Scherfig's light-hearted comedy Italian for Beginners from 2000 showed that Dogma 95 had lost some of the more marked rebellious edge of its earlier titles. All in all, 35 films are officially recognized as part of the Dogma 95, the spirit of which continues to live on to this day. While it's possible that the rise in digital distribution contributed to the movement's downfall, it is possible to identify some of its defiant spirit in films entirely shot, for example, on camera phones and some branches of the global independent film community. The way I see it, Dogma 95 was a shot in the arm of an overly complacent arthouse film scene rather than a real competitor to mainstream filmmaking. Having said that, it's surprising to note how essentially traditionalist many of the Dogma 95 films are, revitalizing timeless narratives and cinematic elements with its exciting, eccentric, and liberating way. If you are new to Dogma 95, I definitely would consider Thomas Vinterberg's Festin, as well as being the first official Dogma 95 film. I think it's the best Dogma 95 film of all time. We'll be back for more film chat on the Big Fred Tuesday in a moment.
Fred.
Joining me at this time on the Big Fred Tuesday from Israel is director Danny Rosenberg, whose film The Death of Cinema and My Father Too is part of this year's Vilnius Film Festival program. Danny, welcome to the show.
Hello, and thank you for having me in the show.
So, all right, so we're going to be talking about your film, The Death of Cinema and My Father Too. I usually say a few lines to introduce the film, but I find it difficult to do so in this case because of just the nature of the film. So for our listeners who are not familiar with it, would you care to maybe say a few words about the story and, just to introduce it?
Well, so the film tells the story of a father and a son that try, because of the father's illness, to stop time, to prevent the father's upcoming death. And they do so by using the power of cinema. That's generally the story of the film. You know, you can say that it's used the commentary and fiction, but the story is very simple. It's a father and a son, and those father and son are fictional character and also a real character because it was my story and my father's story.
So this is very much inspired by your story.
Yes, my father passed away and I tried to make a film with him. And after he's gone, I rewrite it as a fictional a story, yes.
It's essentially so a film that blends reality and fiction. Speaking about your relationship with your father, he was, I take it from watching the film, an influential person who actually helped you and inspired you to become a filmmaker.
You can say that. You can also say that I fight my way to become a filmmaker because he didn't, you know, he loved cinema. And I think my love for cinema starts by watching film with him. Actually, he was into the neorealistic until the 60s, new wave. The 70s, he was, because he himself grew up in Israel during the, you can say, the best days of the European art house cinema, you know, Bergman and Pasolini and Godard and Truffaut, of course. So he was into those kind of films.
Right, the art house stuff.
Yes, the art house, but you know, it wasn't considered art house during the 60s here. It's funny to imagine that people were fighting for tickets for a new Bergman film, but that was Israel in the 60s.
That's true, actually. That just kind of shows how dark, what a dark age we live in today, actually, because I'd take those films any day of the week. But just to return to your film, though, it may be difficult to kind of trace the lineage of this project, but what do you think was the origin of this film?
So it's been a long journey to make this film, but when my father told me that he has the cancer, I wrote a script for him. I wrote a script that tells a story about a man that understand that a war will start the same night with Iran and take his family and run away. It's like a comic, dramatic road trip about one Jewish family that escaped. That was the script. And I want this, my family, to take part in the film. Not only my father to play in it, but also my mother, my grandmother, my brother. Like I made also short films with him, with my father and with my family. And I felt back then that, you know, to make a film together will somehow make the last days of him and for me more influential and more meaningful. We started to shoot, but after 2-3 days of shooting, my father came to me and told me that he was in pain, that he really feel bad, and I stopped the shooting. After I stopped the shooting, so I already bought camera, like a very good camera for film. And I tried to shoot my father. I tried to document my father, but he didn't play along at all. And I stopped those kind of attempts. I do shot my wife back then, that was pregnant. After a couple of weeks, my father passed away. What's happened then? That actually I already got a script and got some money from the Israeli Film Fund. So I told myself, okay, let's do the film. Why not? So then what's happened that I casted one of Israeli known and best actor, like a comedian, to play instead of my father in the film. And I made one day of shooting with him and my mother in bed together a couple of weeks after my father died. And it was so surrealistic and crazy and bizarre to see, you know, this very, very famous actor with my mother, that she didn't understand nothing about what happened. And I understand that, okay, I have to stop the shooting. I have to stop everything. And I rewrote the script completely, like from scratch. And I understand that actually I don't want to make a film about a hero that saved his family. I wanted to make this film because I want my father to be that hero. So I rewrote the script, and now in the new script I wrote, the script told the story about a father and son that tried to make a film together. Actually, the story of me and my father. So I rewrote it. We shot the film. And after we shot it, in the editing process, I understand that actually something is missing, like the center is missing. There is a lot of circles but the center itself of those circles is not there. And the center was actually the original footage I have, like the original life, the real life. And then when I understand it, that the center could not hold, you can say, you know, without the original material. So I changed also the editor of the film and started to work with a new editor. After I worked with a great editor named Guy Nemesh, he was the editor of Foxtrot, but I understand that I need a documentary editor also. So I started to work with Nili Feller. She is a brilliant editor. She worked on Vals with Bashir, for example. She worked on Nadav Lapid's new film. So we start together the process. And for 1 year, we just play with the material, with the documentary and with the fiction, until we got this structure that is now the film.
Right, so it's a hybrid between the documentary and the fiction side of the film. And yes, so exactly. Do you feel that this was also a way for you to deal or confront your father's mortality?
Yes, of course. And in a way, because of, you know, this crazy, bizarre, hard year of the COVID, I feel that I'm still in the process of the film, that the film is not over, you know? And it's for me, it was a way to keep my father alive by working on the film, to process his death. Because, you know, I made the text with him by making audition to other actors that play him. I continue my conversation with him in another way.
We'll be back for more in a moment.
Fred Film Radio.
We are back with Danny Rosenberg, director of The Death of Cinema and My Father Too from the Vilnius Film Festival. So Danny, earlier you talked about your intent, or one of your intents in making this film, being this wish to somehow freeze time. But do you think that cinema really has that power?
Well, obviously, I called the film The Death of Cinema and My Father Too as a way to say, as long as the cinema is alive, as long as we keep on rolling, so the father will not die. It's not the cinema, it's the process that they try to do together to make a film is a way for them to try to prevent the unpreventable. I don't know if this word is
exactly. The inevitable, yeah.
The inevitable. You know, cinema is not a magic. It's not a miracle, but we cinema lovers look at this as a miracle, because it's the miracle in our life. I believe it also in your life. You know, for me, cinema, since I was a child, it's the only way that I understand, you know, the chaos outside, inside the cinema, inside the theater. So things make sense to me.
But when I think of just the very different layers and the many layers of this film, we talked about blending reality with fiction. Did you find it difficult to keep it all together? Because I am also asking this because at the end of the day, even though all of these different dimensions exist in the film, it retains that intimacy to it, which I felt was very important to you.
It was the most important thing. And in the beginning of the editing process, so we tried to make it as a regular film. You know, we wrote all the scenes on cards. We tried to make this linear structure together. But very fast, we understand that we cannot look at this in a kind of a mathematic way. It's more like music. Because if on the paper scenes or sequences seems reasonable, they just didn't work. So we understand that we have to just, you know, throw out the papers and start to play with the materials until we will find a structure that will be solid, you know, and effective. So we just, I think really the word is a playfulness, you know, we just try to understand the balance by watching it again and again, and we invited people to many screenings because we find out that we can see the film through the eyes of other spectators that watch the film. We understand if it's work, if it doesn't, when it's a little bit fell down, when it's go up. So that's what we did. And you know, Neely, that she's really like very, very experienced editor, told me and still tells that that's the most complicated project she ever worked on, because there is no logic in it.
It's, you know, you mentioned the term playful, and I'm thinking that maybe some people, especially when you work in an industry like film, you know, you sort of forget to have that playfulness, and maybe it becomes difficult, right?
Yes, and for me, but you know, I just saw before a couple of days Radu Jude, a new film that won the Golden Bell.
Bad Luck Banging and Loony Porn.
Yes.
The improbably titled, yes. Bad Luck Banging and Loony, yes. Porn.
Yes. And I found out, you know, this film is fascinating. And I that's the cinema that actually, you know, in our days, I want to see those kind of films, because I feel that the basic, the old school structure, it's sometimes I can, you know, you can, because maybe also the internet that just took over our life and the way we watch films, or we just listen to stories in our days. So I look in films this kind of playfulness, because you're not thinking in a narrative way anymore, I feel. You know, you're going, there are so many doors that you open all the time when you are involved in a story. And when creators give you this experience, like Radu Jude, for example, you know, so I feel that it's like the contemporary art that I want to see, that it's really reflect the zeitgeist of our time. And most of the films that actually now you can see in Netflix, it's like, it's the old structure, I feel. There is something a little bit archaic in it.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of Netflix either. I mean, I think that there's potential in Netflix, but as far as their productions go, it's very standardized, and that's not what I want to see when I see films. It's like
yes, exactly.
The McDonald's of cinema.
Yes, but from I want to say not because, you know, they are making great also great production and so on, but I feel that I also made some I wrote a little bit for television. And I feel that because I also find out that I have these skills to make narratives, so it's become so easy, like a mechanic, you know. And when I watch now a TV series, so I really like, I see very fast the structure. You know, here is the plot point, here is the second plot point, here is the 10 minutes before the end. So you have to make some kind of a cliffhanger, you know?
Yeah, and like and usually a lot of montages just to fill the time, though.
Exactly. So I say, okay, so television will take the narrative, so we will win again. We will win the freedom,
right?
In cinema.
Yeah. But, and, you know, just, I feel that when it comes to series, the series structure is afforded more repetition. It feels like sometimes I'm watching the same episode over and over. And, if you were to do that in a film, it would be heavily criticized, because in a film, if you repeat one thing, that's a bad thing, in the, mass audience's viewpoint. But this is a discussion that's very interesting, but it's moving us away from the film, which, yes, does really try to play with the form a lot. And it was well worth pointing that out. While I was watching it, I was prompted to consider, do you think that, the nature of this film, blending reality and fiction, reflects the way in which people just experience life?
Yes, of course. And not people, but I can talk about myself. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I blend life and cinema. I see my sometimes, and also I try to criticize it in the film itself. Because sometimes, you know, not only in this kind of part in my life when I try to make the film with my father, sometimes in other parts, I find out that I see myself as the protagonist of a narrative that I already known, you know, that I, because I'm so much into this film world. So it's in a lot of, especially hard time, hard periods of time in my life. And since I was, you know, I remember because also it's mentioned in the film, my father had very bad years regarding his business that collapsed. And I remember a lot of tension, you know, in the house. And I was then 9 years old, around this time. And it was in the time that Back to the Future, was just got out, Back to the Future 1 and then 2. And I saw Back to the Future, like, I'm not exaggerating, like, maybe 60, 70 times.
Wow.
In cinema, yes.
In the cinema, wow.
And because I had a friend that worked in the cinema, so I just came to see Back to the Future, and you know, I remember that when I was 8, 9 years old, I, like, imagine Marty is coming to me, you know. I really tried to look as my, because there were so many, like, yelling in the house and shouting and tension. And I tried to see my life as a film with a happy end in the last minute.
Yeah, it's a good film.
No, it's an amazing film. And I think that also my interest in time, in a time lapse and in going back and forward in time is also reflects in the death of cinema in my father too. You can say it's some kind of a homage to Back to the Future, because that's what Marty want to do. You know, he want to make his father a hero.
That's interesting. Yeah. And by the way, you know, as you said yourself at the start of at the origins of this project, you were just about to become a father yourself, right? So
yes.
I'm interested to know whether you find that there were parallels between this important stage of your life and you working on this film, or if in any way you feel, given that fatherhood is an important theme of the film, whether working on the film actually helped you through this quote-unquote process.
I hope, you know, the time will tell, but I feel that you know, I also dedicated the film to my son, because I feel that for me working on the film and it was also understand what I am to become a father, what is the point that I want to do better, what is for me actually to take responsibility of someone else's life in the first time, because it's about fatherhood, but it's also about masculinity in a way. I don't want my son to grow up in kind of a toxic environment regarding masculinity that I grown up in, and not regarding also only my father that was, yes, very loving but also very strong man. It was also it is also regarding the Israeli society. It's, you know, violent and tough.
Yeah, that's interesting. Danny, so we've gone over the time and we'll have to wrap it up, but it's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you. I feel the same.
Thank you, Danny, and I wish you all the best. I remind our listeners that the film is called The Death of Cinema and My Father Too. So thanks a lot.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much.
Fred Film Radio.
Chiara Nicoletti interviewed Carlos Alfonso Corral, who presented his debut film, Dirty Feathers, at this year's Berlinale. Here's a clip of that interview.
So, first of all, Carlos, how would you describe Dirty Feathers?
I would describe it more as an experience rather than a story. I think it's an experience for connection, human connection, a longing of the sense of belonging somewhere, like the lack of it, if anything, the lack of human connection and communication and empathy.
I read that the starting point for you was the death of your paternal uncle, who had lived a pretty difficult life. But how did you, from that, how did you decide to make it a film, to make a film out of it,
let's say? Yeah.
inspiration.
Yeah, that was a big impact on my life to see kind of like the misfit of the family, since he was an alcoholic, you know, and growing up like that, it was difficult. And it's easy to be embarrassed by a family member who's an alcoholic. So this embarrassment, this like almost shying away of a person that's family, intrigued me a lot, because just because of their difficulties of what they're going through, we endow this like judgment, and it's prejudice too as at the same time. So I wanted to explore this lack of communication, this lack of connection with someone just because of their difficulties. It's not so much that they're imposing these difficulties on us. It's that they're going through something, and I think we should support them rather than just sit back and judge, you know? So I saw that there was a grander scale of that in the streets of every city I visit. You always see homeless communities, and the fact that, yeah, it's just being ignored. And again, my own prejudice is too, like, you know, a homeless person can walk up to you and you feel this discomfort. And I wanted to break that barrier and immerse myself in this community and learn something from this community.
How did it become so, the story of these people, and how did you find the right balance between, you know, the necessity of giving a direction to the film and the magic, let's say, of being carried away by these people's stories and testimonies?
Yeah, so I didn't have any previous prevision of what the film will look like or what it would look like. And that was precisely why I decided to approach it in this way, was to find something together with them. It was beautiful and remarkable that Brandon, the protagonist of the film, actually came up to me while I was trying to cast the film, and he became a huge collaborator, a creative collaborator. He knew what my intentions were. He knew that I was there to be in service of them. And so he introduced me to his family from the streets, and and he started giving me ideas and he started showing me the way. So it was more of a journey than a preconceived idea. And and we both agreed on the same thing, that, you know, it's not going to be a report, it's going to be an experience. We need to show their experiences. And I think the main important thing was presence, and to be able to, you know, give them time and sit there instead of just 30 seconds of like, hey, tell me your life story and move on. It had to be an experience.
To listen to the full interview, check out fred.fm/UK. That's fred.fm/UK.
Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio.
Cinephile, we have almost reached the end of yet another episode of the BFT, but before we say goodbye for now, it's time for a new segment of Popcorn Classics. And if you're new to the show, this is the segment where I recommend one film that I feel is not talked about as much, but that should be, in the hope that it will help enrich your cinematic ventures and help you earn that coveted black belt in cinephilia. This week's film is I Flunked But... from 1930 by the great Yasujiro Ozu. It's not one of his best known films, but it's one I only recently discovered, and it may even be his first bona fide masterpiece, no matter what IMDb says. Hear me out. Before this film, Ozu was a comedy filmmaker, very much influenced by the great slapstick comedian Harold Lloyd. That influence is still evident in this film, but there's a growing maturity and sense of melancholia that would become more prominent in later of his works, from Late Spring to Tokyo Story and beyond. The story of I Flunked But is about a group of young men about to take a university exam, and about one of them, who seems to be the leader of the pack of sorts, who unexpectedly flunks and doesn't graduate. While the first part is more comedic, as the group is populated by young troublemakers who are more concerned in figuring out ways to cheat in their test rather than doing any actual studying, and who also enjoy having a little dance every now and again, the second part, in comparison, is quite somber. The pace slows down and the camera follows the young man who actually flunks. his concerns, and his state of mind. This is a more reflective Ozu, a side of his artistic persona that would lead to some of the best Japanese dramas of his time. There's also a growing social awareness that is quite visible. The film, after all, is set at a time of a great depression in Japan and of great concern for young students being faced with the threat of unemployment and general hopelessness after graduation. It's also one of his silent films. According to many sources, Japan would be pretty slow in making a full transition to sound. While it may not be a perfect film, any fan of Ozu and Japanese cinema of this period is going to want to watch this one. And as you do, consider that Ozu was only 25 years old when he made the film and already had such control and confidence. It's really remarkable and a sign of genius. So there you have it. This week's popcorn classic is I Flunked But from 1930 by Yasujiro Ozu. With that, it's time for me to say goodbye to you, dear listeners. Don't forget to tune in next week for more Big Fred Tuesday goodness, but allow me to also remind you that we've got plenty of interviews and audio content for you to sink your ears into across all our multiple channels and in multiple languages as well. So if you, like us, are a cinephile or would like to become one, this is a place for you. Till the next time, stay healthy, stay safe, stay strong, stay cinephile, and stay tuned to Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred.
Hello and welcome to Fred Film Radio. I'm Amani Mohammed.
Fred Film Radio, sono Paolo De Marchi.
簡単にその先生の作品のあの紹介を.
Fred Film Radio, sono Dana Knight.
Clémence Ferry-Latour for Fred Film Radio, en direct du Festival de Cannes.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Fred Film Radio.
24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.